the great cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the great cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. What a massive show we've got. Gideon Hay is on the show. ODIs, the David Warner Show. Australia and Pakistan, the preview. That starts today. India versus England, the wrap-up. The law changes proposed by the MCC. The under-19s carnival. Your questions asked TGC. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Dave Edwards and Sam Perry. Chaps, welcome.
Thanks, Egos.
Thank you.
Your introductions are getting more buoyant every weekend. Isn't it a hot one today?
Is it hot enough for you?
How many times have you been asked that today?
83. Never laughed once. Same people who say, is it hot enough for you? The same people say, nice weather for ducks. It's the same.
So this isn't a global enterprise, what we're doing, where people listening over in England or anything like that? Is it hot in England today? It's just Sydney. Sydney-centric. Which is why speaking to Gideon today will be good, because he's based in Melbourne. Was born in London. Trying to try and find out a little bit more about him, like how many test matches he played. I'd never heard of him.
But there
was a couple of ODIs leading into the test matches that we're going to discuss. Last time we spoke, Australia had beaten New Zealand at Manuka Oval in Canberra. Mitch Marsh scored some runs. So let's just quickly wrap what happened
in
the third one. That was in Canberra.
Yep.
Very few people turned up to the MCG. Standard crowd debate about it and whether ODIs should exist at all. Let's just talk about what happened. Australia trounced New Zealand again. The star of the show was David Warner. And I thought we could just talk about Warner for a little bit. Okay. Because all of the reviews of this one-day series has been done. The less said about it, the better. Let's be honest. We know it needs to exist. Respect to the format and its memories in the 90s. But let's talk about...
We were contractually obliged to play that against our closest
exactly.
Neighbors.
Horse trading, I believe. No one wants to play, but a bit of, it's about horse trading between rich nations.
Well, Dave, you said it last week. It was incongruous in the timing of the series. It was mid-series. We had a couple of days to kill. Let's play some ODIs against New Zealand. That
I know whenever I've got a few days to kill. Let's play a 50-over fixture in hot weather.
That is true. We did that all through our youth. David Warner hit 156 off 128 balls. He batted through the innings only to be dismissed off the last ball, and that caused conjecture over whether that meant he carried the bat or he didn't. He didn't. He got out. Carrying the bat in
field. Walk off the field, not out.
And that's doesn't that just mean his innings just meant nothing? I mean, like, talking about just throwing it away. I mean, Renikers. I mean, he was on 156. Like, he could have let that ball go. And just taking the dot ball.
It's not the way he plays, though.
He could have marched into that dressing room. What have you boys ever done? This reminds me of a situation where I put it to you guys. Let's say you're on 99 in your own match. Doesn't matter the standard, and you're on 99. You're on strike. You need four to win. Can you just like knock a single down the ground, just walk down, and then just take your lid off, arms in the air, and celebrate your 100? Because then you could march into that dressing room and say, "Hey, I got 100 not out. What did you boys do?"
Yes. I think you can. I mean, I don't think anything would stop you.
No, but it's selfish, boys. No one wants to be accused of a selfish act on a cricket field.
But you're right. I mean, we're going to talk to Gideon Hay later, who's a master of the classics in literature. There's one thing that I know about him.
Yeah.
And that's like a catch-22 situation by Heller. You know, like everyone in cricket tells you to be selfish and to own the innings and 100 not out looks good in the paper.
Yeah.
What's the problem with it?
But isn't cricket is just, I mean, it's in the moniker of it being a team sport, but it's really just individuals trying to perform for themselves, much in the same way that in a doubles match, really, if one person is performing very well and their partner lets them down, they've played well and then therefore they can, feel good about themselves.
Yeah. Great analogy.
I think nothing more to be said. I think you're talking about something interesting here, though, Higos, because you're talking about selflessness versus selfishness. And just on the Warner point, he's changed. Warner's changed. There's been a lot coming out in the press recently about how he's no longer the bull, he's the reverend.
Yeah.
He's breaking records again and stuff, but he's found he's got a newfound zen.
Yeah.
They've put it down to his work with a former aerobics instructor, with a karate black belt and a triple university degree.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did they exist? Triple university degree? I heard of doubles. Anyway.
Just loves hex debt.
Yeah. And he's a secret weapon behind David Warner's summer scoreboard assault. His name's John Novak. So I've just given
He was hating this publicity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But he of all of those things in his kind of CV that I just read out, yep, the one that stands out to me is that he was the host, the co-host of Aerobics Oz Style between 1986 and 1990. Now, do you guys have a relationship with Aerobics Oz Style?
I do remember it. I think it was on, was it early in the morning, like a 6.30 a.m. Saturdays?
Yeah. Yeah.
Before cricket.
It was very useful as an adolescent male growing up in the era before the internet.
Yeah, for reasons we won't go into.
No,
that's right, cardio.
Pezzy, you mentioned that that Warner is now the Reverend.
Mm.
I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you know, he's the Reverend with a rig. He's got the best pipes I've seen on a religious figure since Pope Benedict.
I've been spending a bit of time thinking about this because Warner obviously used to be the archetypal attack dog. He punched Joe Root in the face. Mm. Now he's gone Zen. 2016 really is the worst year. I mean, I wouldn't have picked. I'll give you three things to happen this year.
Yep.
A Trump presidency, Brexit, Warner becoming Zen and positive. Yep. Which strikes you as the strangest?
Mm. I think Warner was always on the cards for mine. I mean, whenever I look at Dave Warner now, I think born again. He's evangelical born again religion.
Yeah. Cool song.
Even if you look back to that Joe Root incident that you mentioned, he was defending Hashim Amla because Joe Root was wearing a beard that he deemed, you know, to be potentially racist. So he was sticking up for him. So there was always a little bit of that in Dave Warner, and it's just great to see it come to fruition.
Mm. But do you think there's a Ned Flanders element to that? I mean, with Flanders, if you just chipped away enough, beneath it was a very, very angry person. And do you think that we might see that come out with David Warner as well?
Oh, well, I mean, he's obviously drawing on New Age philosophies here. I don't think he's actually religious now. He's probably, he might have a life coach at Bondi Junction. Mm. He might be reading a lot of wellness blogs on the internet.
Well, this is Novak. It's his mind coach. That's what they're calling him.
Novak.
John Novak.
Yep.
So, but see, this is my mistake now because I thought that Dave Warner's secret weapon was his God-gifted ability and years of being a professional cricketer. But in fact, it's just a guy who's just telling him how to chop-kick something.
I think so. I mean, everyone's got to have an edge. The question I had for Warner was that, as you know, he's century seller. He's scoring a lot of hundreds, right?
Loads of tons. Six in one day is in this year.
Loads of tons, loads of records. And whenever he scores 100, he kind of has contractual obligations to commercial sponsors to celebrate in a particular way. We can all imagine it now. But now that he's working for the old Aerobics Oz Style instructor, I wonder if he could just incorporate some Aerobics Oz Style into the century celebrations. You know, step touch, for example. I'd get behind that. I'd get behind Novak. Did you guys read a lot of the reports that came in about how Matt Renshaw, the young 20-year-old who's recently been picked for Australia, had already bought a ticket to the game as a fan back in May?
And then you love those stories?
Yeah, then his missus said, "Nah, you're not allowed to go." Blah, blah, blah. Anyway. Yeah.
What a dilemma.
It took a turn. It took a turn this afternoon.
Is he going to go?
He's not. He's going to play for Australia in the game. But his mates have come out in the press and said because he now can't fill his ticket, they've looked into buying a mannequin to replace him. And they're calling it Mannequin Matt. So they've got his Cricket Australia profile picture. And I thought it was quite interesting because they said, look, there was two ways we could get a picture of his face to sit on the seat. One was just to get the Cricket Australia profile pic, or the other one was to print out a picture of KD Lang.
Right. The famous 90s crooner.
I thought that was quite good from his friends in the press to equate Matt Renshaw now forever as looking like KD Lang, and he does.
So
is it a full sized KD Lang? Because I remember she has quite a quiff to her hair. It'd be a bit annoying if you're sitting directly behind the KD Lang mannequin.
That's an interesting take on it.
Legitimately, haven't seen KD Lang in 25 years.
Yeah, well, you will on Thursday.
But I mean, this is the great thing about the youth policy that Australian cricket should go for is that it involves young Australians, and aren't young Australians just the worst kind of people? They're also 95% of our demographic, by the way. But they just but they'll come up with this kind of hijinks.
Yeah,
and I'm all for it. It's a nice little story, isn't it? It's well played. Well, it's banter.
You can bet that if Channel 9 had been reading the ABC's article that I read today, then there will be plenty of shots into Section 30 of the Gabba looking for a mannequin Matt. Mm. But let's talk about the match.
There's cricket to be played.
Okay. Right. The first thing that's going to be on people's agenda is Amir from Pakistan.
Yeah.
Muhammad Amir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys have what do you think about his
Well, it's interesting how many people called Faf du Plessis a cheat. because he put his lolly saliva onto the cricket ball, and that's how we lost two test matches by, you know, a million runs and 43 wickets.
The Amir story is definitely the big story, isn't it? And has he paid his dues? I mean, he has gone away,
paid his dues.
He's like the, you know, he's like the club president who's done a bit of time for tax fraud, and he's come back, welcomed into the club, no dramas. You know, you welcome those kind of guys back, and he adds a lot of value.
Yeah.
And at the Gabba, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about the Gabba in a moment, but did you see how Amir performed in that CA11 game where he took, I think, a 4-for-3 in a few overs?
Yeah.
Under lights with a pink ball.
Yeah.
He's going to be tough to face.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to seeing him. And, you know, if you are listening to the show and you've got any kind of contribution to the public discourse, please don't write about him or talk about him as making a comeback. He's made the comeback. Mm. It's happened. We weren't even part of the story. He's done it. He's gone to Lords where it happened. We try and insert ourselves into it. It's done. Let's just enjoy him bowling. Because he hoops it around, and then we'll start hating him when he starts getting guys out.
So I was in the UK when that happened, when that went down, and I was playing for a club in Surrey. And about 2 months after he got his 5-year ban, and someone Asif were in jail. So his ban was a ban from all cricket, all cricket matches he was not allowed to play in. About 2 months afterwards, he appeared in a village cricket match in Surrey where he opened the batting and bowling, and he came off his long run. And he smoked like 60, like as if that would like fly under the radar. Yeah. But also, he's a test match cricketer.
Yeah.
Why are you playing in a village game like after you've got your ban when you're like with the biggest story in the UK? It was very fascinating.
He's obviously never heard of the internet or social media. I'm sure 50,000 blokes took photos and uploaded them straight away.
One of the other tantalising subplots to Australia-Pakistan, yes, is the return of ex-Australian coach Mickey Arthur. He has coached a bunch of other places as well, but that's... Mm. It's kind of bubbling away. He's overseen a Pakistan side that was number one for a long time, against the odds as well.
Yep.
And, sorry, you're like my hype man as I'm talking because I feel like I'm a hip-hop artist and you're just in the back going, yeah.
And, I'm waving a towel. Yeah.
But they've just been pretty comprehensively beaten in New Zealand as well.
Comprehensively beaten New Zealand.
Away from home. So is Arthur Foxing, how much does he want this?
Has anyone asked him about homework gate yet?
I reckon he was.
Because is just so inextricably tied to that stupid word all these years later.
It's a lead article today.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. What are your reflections on homework gate? Do you regret homework gate?
Yeah, that's
it. I bet he regrets it because he's continually being asked it by terrible journalists for clickbait purposes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He said he was possibly too harsh on them, but he also needed to make a stand.
Well, I mean, what about the showdown between Mickey Arthur and Darren Lehman? It's really, you know, it's the intellectual versus the alpha dog.
It's the alpha showdown, yeah. We spoke to Rob Quiney a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about how Rob Quiney said to us that it was Mickey Arthur who described his eight as the greatest eight of all time.
Yeah.
And that sort of stuck with him. And I think that actually annoyed Bobby a little bit because he didn't ask for that. And it's been, seems to be, you know, a lot of attention and unnecessary, you know, publicity for Bobby on his career.
It is funny how words can stick with particular things, champ.
We can't
run away from that.
Lads, I reckon Mickey Arthur wants this and he wants it bad. I reckon, like, I mean...
He's Eddie Jones, basically. What Eddie Jones is doing for England in the rugby.
Yep.
That's what Mickey Arthur needs. He needs this. Yeah. He really needs this.
Yeah.
Rugby Union for Melbourne listeners. There are other sports,
There are other sports available.
But if you are Mickey Arthur and you're sitting down in your leather chair, let's say, and he's maybe relaxing, he's got a scotch or something, and he's trying to figure out his blue sky scenario for cricket over the next few months, would it not involve a shellacking of Australia on their home deck? And don't forget, Pakistan beat England at home with this pretty much the same side last year. And... this year, and following that, Australia to go to India and lose in the way that England are losing now, and just mirroring exactly what happened to Arthur.
So I think the purists want a strong Pakistan team to come out here. I certainly do, because I said before, when Pakistan are doing well, I think it's really exciting when they're doing well. Unfortunately, they are terrible away from home, the same as India. They don't travel well, and it's really frustrating for me to see them lose in New Zealand against not a particularly strong New Zealand team who's not on the back of a lot of form, because Pakistan have got a really exciting... They've got Wahab Reyes. There was obviously that infamous showdown at the Adelaide Oval against Shane Watson in the World Cup. Shah, the best leg spinner in the world, who's been mentored by Shane Warne. And then the return of Muhammad Amir, let alone a wonderful batting lineup.
They've always had real match winners, haven't they, Pakistan, over the years? Mm. You know, you've reeled off some of those names earlier in the podcast. Mm. And we always expect precociousness from Pakistan, don't we? We expect them to be mercurial, all these those words will obviously be used by Mark Nicholas within the first 5 minutes of the coverage at the Gabba. But, I mean, what do we really think is going to happen in this series, honestly?
I actually think that, I mean, this is perhaps a reflex to me thinking Australia would steamroll South Africa, who were at a comparably worse
very,
situation.
Very boldly in the first episode.
I did. And we all know what happened. You mentioned he goes that they travel badly, but I can't ignore that they beat England in England when people didn't think they could. Mm. And I honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if Arthur's held them back a little bit in New Zealand in a very relatively low profile match. Right. It's a 3-match series. Mm. They're playing. They've got wonderful swing bowlers playing a day night test at the Gabba, and you know, two batsmen in Misbah Ul Haq and Yunus Khan, 42 and 39 respectively, who still score runs in their late 40s, you know, averaging in the late 40s. Yeah. You know, they're every chance.
Against a side who isn't that good.
Yeah.
We're a nervous side. There's three guys playing their second test match ever.
Australia is not what it used to be. We're not Hayden Langer-Ponning, Mark or Martin, Steve or Gilchrist anymore, are we? Well, who are the top six? Can you say it quickly?
No. KD Lang.
So if we can be earnest, I mean, we sort of have answered a bit. I mean, I think what it comes down to is the wickets. And something that our article touches on, if you can read today on Fox Sports website, is someone knows everything about pitches. But, I mean, I think, like, I still can't believe that we lost to South Africa. Like, you look at how that series panned out. They didn't have Steyn. Morkel didn't play. AB de Villiers wasn't available.
Yeah.
And Hashim Amla averaged 19 for the series, and they beat us 2-1. And they smashed us in the first two test matches. Yeah. But I think that was as much a reflection about the state of the pitches that were prepared by Cricket Australia or the curators for those grounds that the matches were played, as much as like it was really surprising that they allowed green seamers.
Yeah.
And I think if the Gabba is a green seamer, I think Pakistan will win because I think they've got a superior bowling, more balanced bowling attack, I think.
Do you reckon there's a lot of pressure on curators more now than there ever was because of commercial imperatives?
Yeah, they need 5 days. Yeah.
And people want to talk about it in the lead up, you know, speculation about the pitch and what it's going to do.
Yeah.
It's always going to do a bit early.
it's just one of the safest things you can say in cricket.
Even on synthetic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, look, Brisbane under lights as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bingo games you can play with talking about Brisbane cricket, as you can with every state. But with Brisbane cricket, how long until, you know, before we start seeing highlights of Michael Slater's 100 against England in the Ashes in 94 or Warne's a zillion wickets or Brett Lee's 6?
Or Hussain winning the toss of the Gabba and then bowling first and then Australia get a million on the first day. Adam Dale's catch. It'll be in the first... It'll be in the first segment of the show.
First hour, pre-show.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about the conditions.
Yeah.
I mean, but almost too much. Is the Gabba really that humid? Like, we're not playing in Bali. Like, it's still Queensland. Is it going to do that much?
No, I don't know. But it's like the spinners have the best record there. Nathan Lyon's got his best record there. Shane Warne had his best record there.
Is it another fallacy like the Wacker is, you know, this outdated?
I don't think it is like we talk about the Brisbane Storm, like the storms happening in Brisbane in the afternoon. It actually is the perfect storm. Like you're looking at the first time a humid place is using a pink ball under lights in a scenario where they need the test to go for 5 days, which just normally means you're going to make flat wickets. Really what it means is nobody has any effing idea what's going to happen and therefore we talk about it for ages and hope for different things.
And then we'll know in 2 overs in what's going to happen.
That's right. Warne hits 3 fours in the over and the series is done.
Bang. So Australia's going to win 5-0 in 3-test series. Well done. Boy, should we talk about the MCC proposing some regulations? Should we move on to that?
Yeah, probably.
You've really sold it. Let's talk about some regulations.
What about like widespread law changing cricket? Yeah. Laws rewritten in cricket.
Yeah.
You know, the law based game.
So the three proposed changes are
There's a book called Cricket and the Law, written by a barrister.
Ripping read.
Yeah.
Ripping read. Bedside stuff.
That bloke hated his wife. Let's call a spade a spade here. He really did not want to spend any time with her. So the laws that are proposed are that bats can't get any bigger or any deeper.
Yeah.
No more deeper bats.
Yeah.
There's also some
Look
yellow...
Look how deep that bat is.
Oh,
have you ever
heard
that before?
No.
Keep carrying on.
Yellow and red cards for bad on-field behaviour.
Right.
I mean, that's weird.
Yeah, so apparently there's been some huge reports of violence at lower-level cricket in England specifically.
So this is across all cricket competitions globally.
Yeah. Well, the example they use, they put up Mike Brearley, the ex-England captain, and Ricky Ponting to sort of sell these proposed changes, which will come through next October.
No better salesman than Mike Brearley.
That's right, and I've always said that. And both of them were really clear. They had their, you know, talking points, obviously, but they're both really clear that it's not an issue at the upper end of the higher levels of the game. It's a real issue at the lower end of the game. And there was a university study done by Portsmouth University that revealed 56.2% of the 763 umpires, it had to be cricket stats so there, didn't it? Yeah. Surveyed had experienced verbal abuse and 21 had reported physical violence. So it was more of an issue of people not wanting to umpire the game anymore because of the way people carried on.
Did they qualify how many arson attacks on pavilions there have been across the board?
Well, we've had at least three or four write to us about that.
Yeah. Keep sending them in. It's interesting to see how people react to an LBW.
I'm really surprised by the number of physical assaults being seen on cricket fields because I've never actually seen one. Yep. I've heard of one story, and I keep in mind, you guys, that I've played cricket for a long time, but I've heard of one story of physical violence. So, like, and England as well, like, for, I mean, it's even more polite there.
Well, it's strictly a non-violent game. It's non-contact. So you really have to want it to get a red card. I can't imagine what a red card would look like in cricket.
Yeah.
It's got to be a physical confrontation.
Yeah.
Like, Mike Brearley said that cricket is the only game, apart from Australian rules football, in which there isn't a possibility of an in-match deterrent for bad behaviour.
Fair point.
I'd like to see AFL introduce that before cricket does, though.
But the AFL's very reluctant to change anything. I mean, they still come back next week if there's a tie in the grand final. So they're going to be the last.
Well, the game's in rude health.
Rude.
So I think that the reason why cricket is such a, like, you get so much verbal attacking in cricket is because that you can't physically nut it out with someone. You know, like in a rugby game, it's all like you smash each other for 80 minutes and then it's handshakes and you drink with the other team. Yeah. You know, football, as in soccer, it's a bit the same. It's physical in that there are some crunching tackles, but you can't actually hurt someone unless you break their leg.
That's very interesting. It's kind of like the legalizing drugs theory. Sure. You know, if you just make it available to all, it stops becoming a little of this kind of titillating thing. So you're saying there'd be less sledging if you could just hit people. What I want to ask is
probably, like,
less burns, in what scenarios would you say you're in the field? You just wanted to hit the batsman, like
it's the last game of the season. You're not going to make the finals.
Yeah. Well, like, you just at second slip, they hit a four. This is no good.
Okay, so the situation is let's go back to the two runs to win on the last ball, and the batsman hits a single, and they need to get to retip round at the bowler's end. Cover fielder swoops, kicks it up, misses the stumps, and then misses the stumps, and the batsman sliding to make the run hits the bat, and then it goes into the outfield, and the second run is on. Now cricket etiquette suggests that you are not allowed to run because it touched it, therefore the batsman impeded the fielder and you can't. But if you're going to win the game, are you going for that second run? So let's say the batsman turns for that second run. I want nine blokes tackling that batsman.
Oh, you can actually physically impede people.
Physically.
Stop that run happening. So no one will ever win a game.
He goes,
there'll never be a result.
It's not legalising drugs. This is legalising guns.
You're not
solving issues with your words anymore in cricket.
More guns will lead to less violence, apparently.
Yeah. That's how it works. Yeah.
Okay, so that's sorted. I think we're in agreement. Deep bats.
Good. Well, I actually think that enough. I think enough is enough with the bats, and here's why. Purely on statistical analysis.
Zero tolerance.
Zero tolerance on deeper bats.
Yeah. As much violence as possible.
Have as many guns as you want. Stop the ammunition. No, what I'm saying is that the big bats, like it's gone too far. Because, for instance, like if Bradman had the bat that Glenn Maxwell was using, Bradman would have averaged 342.63.
Well,
and that's a fact.
I mean, we talked we're talking with Gideon Hay in a moment. You just look at the Trumper picture that his book is hinged upon.
Yeah.
Look at how small that bat is.
Yeah, toothpick.
It's a dead set toothpick.
Yeah. But I mean, legitimately, like, you can mistime a ball for six now, and even when Ricky Ponting was going around, and let's say in 2004, he had that, what was it? The back of his bat was black. What was it? Carbon fiber or something like that.
Yeah.
It was deemed illegal.
Right. Yes.
But even that bat, or like, better example, David Warner, when he made his debut in the T20 against South Africa, the MCG, scored 88. And you look at the size of the bat he was using then. It's a lot smaller than what he's using now.
But it was frighteningly large to the viewer back then.
Exactly, yeah. But so I just think that
we're just used to it. It's like the NBN. We're just used to fast broadband. You know, we can't go back to dial-up.
I think it's such a batsman's game, and there's this perception in cricket that, like, everyone wants to see in a one-day international 450 plays 440. But I think what people want to see more likely is 37 plays 40.
I mean, I'm making silly metaphorical analogies, but it's kind of like performance-enhancing drugs. Like, where would it end with bats? If you could just have as big a bat as possible, would it be like those oversized golf clubs?
Bat as wide as the pitch.
You just come out, yeah, with a bat as wide as the ground. Yeah. You just put it up. I'm not getting out.
Yeah. Your move, MCC.
Yeah.
I've got the biggest bat in the world.
The game would be a lot worse if we were in charge. It's always
we're going to talk quickly about India and England because that's probably the biggest series that's going on at the moment. It's one place two.
Yep.
So when we last spoke, England was still in the series and there was some positivity around them in terms of the runs that they've been scoring over there and unearthing a few new players, a few young players, Haseeb Hameed being one. He got injured. They brought in Keaton Jennings to the fourth test. Keaton Jennings hit 100 on debut. England hit 400 in the first innings. They came back from that scenario a couple of years ago to do well in the series. This time, though, they got absolutely slaughtered. India made 630-odd, declared. Kohli made a double ton.
Yeah.
Jadeja may run. No, someone else may run as well. Anyway, carry on. And then they bowled England out for about 100 and won by an innings and 30.
And now all we're hearing is that heads must roll.
Heads got to roll.
Is Cook the one to go? I mean, he's the captain. Should his head
roll? There's talk about Alistair Cook perhaps relinquishing the captaincy. I think the verb is important. Does he resign? Is he sacked? Or does he relinquish, which is a little bit more kind of opaque in terms of the way it works?
I think this is a precursor to what we're going to see in 6 months' time when we go to India, in that if Australia, let's say Australia draw the series against Pakistan, or it's even if it's a narrow win, we will get pumped in India, like we will.
And so do we have to lose half of our side when the result is already almost a foregone conclusion? Like, is our commitment to winning that big that we can't just allow the side to go through that? I'd be thinking about resting players so as to not go through the psychological torment of it.
But maybe the torment would be good. You know, that's a real opportunity to learn from, you know, a terrible experience.
Yes.
Life lessons.
Yes. But the problem is they'll struggle and they won't be it won't be a rewarding experience going through that. And then the public pressure will be such that we will demand heads to roll. And I suspect Steve Smith, who's already under a little bit of pressure in terms of his captaincy, he's going to go to India. And if we lose, is it a 3-test series or is it a 5-test series?
I think it's 4.
Is it 4? Okay. Yeah. So I had 3 options and I got it wrong. Yeah. And if we lose that series 4-0, which you've got to say is a distinct possibility, he's going to be in serious trouble for his job.
Yes, but he shouldn't be. Like, we're all going to know.
His job.
Yeah, because there's just this reflex of, like, if you underperform, even though it's all expected, you've got to go. It's just this kind of symbolic thing that must happen. You say that we're going to struggle. There's been some correspondence come out from none other than intrepid, commenter on cricket, Dean Jones, who has a piece in a new book of his with a quote from VVS Laxman saying that Australians have been gardening wickets incorrectly this whole time.
Right.
If I could just kind of paraphrase VVS, he says the Australians tend to kick off any small bits of turf and not fill these holes that sometimes have sharp edges to them. Indians, we look after our office. You always got to keep your office clean. You got to keep your bedroom clean. It's about keeping your workplace clean. He just kept talking about the cleanliness of his workplace. And he said they actually fill in the holes with any debris that might be on the pitch. So they see the stuff that's on the pitch and go, I could use that.
Yeah.
It's sustainable living. Yeah, it's actually using what's there to continue your
existence.
Australians
even garden aggressively.
Mm.
But in my mind, I can just see Ricky Ponting kicking the wicket with his heel. Mm. That's how he swept the wicket around to clear it up. That's wrong.
It's funny to think of the pitch as a desk, or kind of like a shared workspace. It's like a Regis building. There's always different companies there. You've got a shared receptionist, but your desk is an absolute mess.
It's exactly.
Bad.
Standing desk, though. It's a standing desk.
Yeah, standing desk. Well, where does that come into play? Yeah. But I love the idea of, because I'd never considered that before. I don't think anyone in Australia had that. You can see a cricket wicket and go, that piece will fit really well in this uneven piece here.
Yeah.
Where does that end? I mean, we love renovation rescue at Homes and Gardens. You know, we start having reality TV shows
so
about
how does it work? Do they,
cleaning up
do they
a pitch.
Just use their bat to nurdle it into the crevice?
Yeah.
Or do you just pick it up?
So they think the ball spins less or spins with more evenness if you fill in the holes, whereas we kick debris away, making sharp edges.
Yeah, Renault Rumble.
Exactly.
Renault Rumble. I mean, going back to the England series, I mean, for mine, like anybody who's getting sacked for losing a series in India or hints that he should resign, I think, is way too far. I think Alistair Cook is doing a fine job, and I think Joe, for him, is a little bit too early. I know in my mind he's still a 14-year-old boy or Ellen DeGeneres.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think it's a little bit too soon for Root just yet, and I think Cook's got a lot to offer.
I'm sure the ECB will take that on board.
Gideon Hay coming up.
This summer, we've got the biggest renovation challenge yet. Two teams will have to transform not one, but two broken down grade cricket dressing rooms every single week. There will be tension.
What even is grade cricket, Dazza? Why did we take time off work to do this?
Come on, Charlesy. Work hard, love.
There will be drama.
I just want to make this perfect. Grade cricket deserves a great home.
But when the reveal comes, there will be joy.
Oh God. Lads. Boys. Look at this, right? Results.
Ever since the missus booted me out and took the kids, I've been sleeping in this dressing room. It's a second home to me, literally. So this is really special.
For us to be able to come in and give these grade cricketers a beautiful new dressing room, one they can drink their beers in, sing the club song, judge each other in the showers, yeah, you know, it makes you feel good.
But this ain't no charity. Not when the stakes are this high.
I'm not here for a bloody holiday. If I wanted that, I would have gone to Bali or Thailand.
It's Australia's toughest renovation competition. Winner takes all.
If I have to dish out a little bit of chin music, I will.
Presented by Australia's favourite knockabout blue-collared larrikin millionaire.
We're giving great cricket the reno makeover it deserves.
Reno Rampage. Coming soon.
Boys, the guy we're about to speak to has been writing about sport, business, both and neither for more than 30 years. He's contributed to more than 100 newspapers and magazines. He's written 32 books and edited 7 others, or though some say 30 books. There's a bit of conjecture that we'll ask him about, my cricket, etc., sure. Statistics. Mm. The esteemed publication The Observer declared him about him in 2005, if Flintoff is the cricketer that England waited 2 decades for, this man may be the writer for a game that inspires literature. He can do comical, historical and tactical. He can also quote Hobbs Baum, G.K. Chesterton and Mark Twain and not sound as if he's showing off. It is our great pleasure to welcome Gideon Hay. Gideon, welcome to the Great Cricketer.
It's an honour. It's an honour that I've been waiting for. This is the culmination of my entire career.
And just for a bit of background, you've just said to us that you're speaking to us from a flip phone. The battery may go dead. And you're also at a cricket game at the moment.
I am. I'm at the Matty Shield game at Toorak Park watching Box Hill ladies play Paran ladies. And it is a beautiful summer scene, a gorgeous suburban oval. Meg Lanning in the centre, and it's pretty glorious, actually. Fantastic ground here, great atmosphere, and some very high-quality cricket going on in the middle.
Gids, that sounds fantastic, and I think we generally start the
podcast... We're calling him Gids.
Yeah, Gids, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, we've met once before, so that's how we're going. Yeah. Look, we usually start the podcast the same way every week. Just to kind of ask a bit about your relationship to club cricket, I know that you... your team, the Yarras, you're obviously very fond of that and have a strong relationship with them. Maybe you can kind of talk to us about your current relationship with the grade system.
Fondness really doesn't kind of cover it. It's a sort of a tormented, tumultuous love affair that I've had with this club for 22 years.
Still been treated
me pretty meanly at times, but I keep coming back for more.
Have you ever paid subs?
I haven't paid subs, despite the fact that I'm an honorary life member. I go on plugging away, and look, you know, I'm the game's record holder, and I tell you what, there, I've got my BDI on number 2 and 3 on the game's list too, and I don't like it when they're playing, and I'm not. I've broken my finger 3 weeks ago, so I've been out since then, but I'm determined to get back this weekend.
Is that your writing finger?
No, it's my ring finger on my left hand, so I can't get my wedding ring on at the moment, which was causing my wife great chagrin.
So, are you on more circuits now?
I could easily do that. I'm not sure my wife would notice. If I told her I was going to cricket, she'd just look the other way.
I guess, Gideon, we're talking about your time at the Yarras. I don't think as many people would be as familiar with you as a player versus you as a writer. So I looked up your My Cricket stats. And if you wouldn't mind, I know this is probably the worst thing. This is the worst way you can alpha somebody on air. But I think it's something to be proud of. 3,880 runs at a batting average of 20 and a highest score of 92. We'll get to that in a second. 312 wickets at 16.57 and best bowling of 6 for 6. My question to you, Gideon, is how would Gideon Hay describe Gideon Hay as a cricketer?
I tell you what, I'd love to face myself. I sort of dream of that. I'm sure that there's some virtual reality simulation on the cards that will enable me to do that eventually. But I've always longed to tonk myself all over the park.
There's something Freudian about this.
Yeah, I know how few wiles I've actually got. The 92, interestingly, it took me all day, and it was the last two-day game that I played. I sort of suddenly slipped below that plimsoll line that distinguishes two-day cricketer from one-day cricket. So I went out on a high, or if you can describe making 92 in a day as a high, and ever since then I've been sort of scraping the bottom of the barrel I'm down to the fifths now.
Kids, Sam and I actually played a cameo with your team last season. I think you compiled a pretty neat 40 or 50 odd not out.
Even 50.
Yeah.
And hey, would you like to talk us through your performance?
No, we won't go there. I wasn't planning on going there. It wasn't unnoticed on my behalf that most of these runs came behind square, kind of nurdling the ball in that respect. I'm just wondering when the last time it was that you kind of opened the shoulders and hit a maximum for the Arrows.
50s, whether it's nurdled or not, Sam. I must say that that magnificent straight drive, which surprised me almost as much as it surprised the bowler.
So, Gideon, I mean, on to what you're most well known for, and rightly so. We spoke with Brendan Julian, I wouldn't call him as a contemporary of yours, a couple of weeks ago about the state of Australian cricket writing and cricket commentary. And, you know, many people would argue, including me, that you're the best in the world at it. And I don't mean to be sycophantic about it. But I wanted to ask you while we have you here, what do you think makes good cricket writing? Who do you admire? And as a third appendix, if you will, what's the place of social media in cricket?
God, it's got no place in my life. That last question is very easily answered in my case. Well, I mean, what makes good cricket writing? Good writing. Good writing, that's the simplest answer. You know, fresh, lucid, lively prose, you know, illuminated by original thinking that doesn't take itself too seriously. It's not rocket surgery, cricket writing. It shares all the attributes that one sort of associates with quality literature. Sometimes I think we overemphasize the cricket and we underemphasize the writing. Every piece of writing should be a pleasure to read and to leave the reader feeling, subtly illuminated afterwards. I take a lot of care over my writing because I don't know, that's the kind of person that I am. But maybe the writing these days has become a bit of an afterthought, and that we're so sort of obsessed with the idea that you need to have cricket credentials, as it were, in order to have an opinion. That we've forgotten that ultimately it's about the reading experience as much as it is about the conveyance of a view.
Yeah, Gideon. I mean, you've got a book out at the moment. Speaking of writing, it's on Victor Trumper. It's called Stroke of Genius. You could be forgiven, I think, in this country for thinking that Australian cricket history kind of began and ended with Bradman. But, of course, Trumper was really the first iconic cricketer. Can you just run us through a little bit about Trumper and what made him kind of so brilliant compared to his peers?
Well, iconic is a very good word to use in his case. I mean, it's often overused in the context of contemporary culture, but he exists these days primarily as an icon, as a visual figure. He's probably the first figure, in fact, who was cricketing figure who was chiefly bequeathed to history in a visual form. I mean, the bones of Trumper's career are that he played 48 test matches between 1899 and 1912 and made 3,613 runs at an average of 39.04 and made 800s. But, I mean, that's the least interesting thing about him. Yeah. It's his significance as an embodiment of a certain kind of Australian cricketer. He creates a sort of a blueprint an originating form for the kind of the idea of Australian cricketers being sort of attacking, aggressive, taking the game on, and showing a certain style and brio and generosity in doing so. He was as famous for his blameless character as he was for his immensely stylish batting. The interesting thing is that up until Trumper, Australian cricket had been identified with a pretty austere style of cricket, that we were known to be sort of resilient and practical, but not particularly adventurous. But Trumper is the kind of guy who breaks the mould of Australian cricket before him and leaves it ever after changed. And in that sense, the idea that he could be summed up in a single image playing a beautiful attacking shot is actually not misleading at all. And that's one of the reasons why the image so resonated with people at the time and makes such a natural fit with those sort of half-remembered factoids that we have about the legend.
He's actually a club legend of my club here in Sydney, Gordon, and I'm fairly certain, I know for a fact there's a story, I don't know how true it is because I haven't checked on my cricket because it wasn't available when he was playing, but he scored 300 in a day. And I don't know if that's the... He was good. Yeah, he was good, yeah. But I don't know how that's possible, given he played on uncovered wickets, wasn't sponsored, and was batting with a toothpick.
Yeah.
Well, he made 335 in 3 hours.
I was just playing, 3 hours.
Playing for Gordon against Redfern.
Right.
But
it was 8 ball overs back then, so it's a bit different.
Race through them.
Actually, it wasn't. It wasn't 8 ball overs until the 1920s. But yeah, I mean, his scoring rate, they didn't keep ball-by-ball stats in those days, but his scoring rate, I think, in runs per minute, is still unequalled in Test cricket. I think Adam Gilchrist is probably the closest who's come to it.
If we can move sort of 100 years down the line of Australian cricketers, I mean, Shane Warne is someone who has captured the imagination for many reasons, he and his new face. But you wrote a book that the three of us in studio here have thoroughly enjoyed, On Warne. And I just wanted to ask you, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that you first met him in, was it 1994, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And one of your first meetings with him, you sort of noticed that then he was like struggling with coming to terms with his fame. How do you see Warne's evolution from when you met him to as far along as today?
I don't think he was struggling.
Okay.
I think he was getting used to it, but I think he actually had kind of got to like it. I don't think there's ever been a man in Australian cricket history who's been as comfortable with the trappings of fame as Shane Warne. It took him very little time to get used to being the centre of attention, and there's part of him that's always gone on loving that role. Back in those days, he was coming to terms with the idea that everyone would have a view about him, even though they hadn't met him, which is a confronting idea for someone who, I think he was only 24 at that age. The idea that, you know, when he walks into a room, everyone's going to already know who he is and have a view about him. But, you know, the way in which he uttered that sentiment, which he actually articulated to me at the end of our interview, was someone who was just rolling it round in the back of their head. It wasn't a terrible thing. It wasn't a malign development. It was just something that he knew that he was going to have to get used to, and he was right.
Gideon, if we can now just jump back 70 years. Because we like to
do things in a linear fashion. To when you bought your current phone.
Look, I want to talk briefly about Bradman if we can, because, you know, sure. We like to make a lot of jokes on this podcast about Bradman, mainly because he's been treated like a god in this country, but also it's funny to think about how he'd go in the modern era of, you know, aggressive alpha-grade cricket.
Yeah.
But it's been years since Bradman passed, and you've written about Bradman extensively. I'm just wondering what you think about the legacy of Bradman and whether it will indeed live on, in the next 20, 30 years. How's it going today? Or will it kind of just be reduced to, you know, just the 99.94 average the final vestige?
Well, I think it's, we're an increasingly statistically focused game. So in that sense, you know, that corner of the game is going to be preserved forever in his image. He is going to be the benchmark. In some respects, every sport would like a Bradman figure, and cricket's good fortune is that it already has one. I mean, I suspect that the legend will go on being contested. I mean, the kind of the phenomenon that you're talking about, that sort of late period rediscovery of Bradman by the kind of the forces of social conservatism in Australia, you know, the idea of the greatest living Australian and then the greatest dead Australian, kind of became a bit, it was irritating. It was something that you instinctively reacted against. But there's no doubt that Bradman's been more successful as a thing that Australians value than anyone in sort of any comparable walk of life. I mean, the fact is that it's quantifiable, his degree of superiority. That's one of the fundamentally reductive things about sport. But it does mean that you can sort of estimate his prowess relative to the competition. I mean, in a sense, we've gone on telling ourselves the same story about Bradman over and over again. That, if anything, that would be my criticism of the way in which Bradman's been studied. We only want to know about, you know, the period, the 20-year period where he was at the peak of his powers, and the rest of his life fades into insignificance. We've betrayed a kind of a bit of an incuriosity, a genuine incuriosity about the figure.
We don't want to know.
Because we want to go, we don't want to know. We want to go on believing in it. It's just such a marvelous story that if you you don't want to interfere with something that's so comforting, so reassuring.
I get the impression, Gideon, that you're somebody who might be so courageous as to inquire as to the parts that we might not want to know about. Well, what are the parts about Bradman do you think Australia might not want to inquire about?
Sectarian violence.
They're not necessarily, and it's not necessary that you have to penetrate the secrets of Bradman.
Mm. I mean, you just have to ask the question.
In a way, a lot of that kind of biographical grist for the mill has kind of gone by the board because all Bradman's contemporaries are dead. And his literary estate is basically can't be touched because the copyright will be controlled until 75 years after his death. So the possibilities of adding significantly to an intimate understanding of Bradman's life are remote. But the context of Bradman's fame and the context of the country that he inhabited and the institutions that he helped to shape, I don't think we understand those well at all. We basically just keep on talking about the 99.94 and reciting the scores off the top of our head, which I've no doubt that you three boys can do because you're sort of natural cricketing patriots.
Gideon, if I can now move along to 100 years' time from now, I want to ask you about where the game's going. And perhaps 100 years is a little bit too long. That's said in jest. But, I mean, something that you're a part of is the documentary Death of a Gentleman, which is really fascinating in terms of, and speaks of Australia's place amongst India and England and really the monopoly, the monopolising of cricket in those countries. I mean, if you could speak freely about that for a little bit, and then perhaps where do you see the game as going? Because, I mean, do you see the game as slowly dying out in terms of numbers being played in a competitive environment, or do you see the game as strong as ever?
Well, I mean, the economy of cricket is unlike the economy of any other comparable sport. No other single country is so dominant in its sport, economically speaking, as India is in cricket. Sure. And that is having kind of a distorting effect on the shape of the game.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's the Indian consumer who is going to have the decisive say in the direction of the game, and we're all really spectators to that. And I don't think even the people who are running the game in India really understand the direction in which the game is headed. They're sort of climbing aboard this giant elephant that's sort of rumbling off down the road. We're not quite sure where it's going to lead, but it's probably going to make them quite a lot of money in the interim. We are seeing the collapse, you're right, of the system of international cricket as we've known it. It was remarkably stable for a very long time. It's amazing that the institution of the Test match has withstood challenge for such a long period, having been invented, you know, in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
I guess the next sort of interesting step, and I guess one of the things that perhaps we're sort of unaware of, is the sort of the stealth corporatization of the game. I mean, we're accustomed to the idea that there are all these influences now external to the game that are having influences over it. There's, you know, there's the players, the administrators, government, broadcasters, sponsors, the Supreme Court of India, which is having a pretty big say in the way in which cricket is run in India at the moment. But also, I think that private capital is probably the next shoe to drop, as it were. Already it's basically runs the IPL, that's tied itself to Indian corporate fortunes. But I suspect that the next step will be possibly the sale of BBL franchises in Australia. I suspect it might already have happened if the money had been available to do it. Some of the IPL owners have already reached out to the Caribbean Premier League. Perhaps the next step will be kind of transnational corporate institutions controlling different sporting properties, and that's going to have an effect on the existing institutional structures of cricket, which we can't quite predict.
A thorough answer, getting into a possibly dystopian future for cricket, depending on when you were born, I guess. We're going to move on to a lighter part of the interview, if that's okay with you, Gideon,
sure.
Throwdowns. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but we give you...
I'm familiar with throwdowns. I do quite like them, I must say.
You won't like these.
Yeah.
And they feel much, much better.
We, they do. They're like a cure, aren't they?
Comfort food for cricketers. Yeah. An elixir.
We'll ask you a question, and we'll just ask you to answer as quickly as possible, maybe 10 seconds maximum.
Yeah, sure.
So I'll kick off. Gideon, as we know, cricketers operate in a feudal society where respect is conferred in direct relation to runs scored, wickets taken and test matches played. Does the same system exist in cricket writing? And if so, how many times have you said to people, how many books have you written, champ?
It's never come to mind, I must say. Knowing full well that none of the potential respondents would have read a single one of those books.
Gideon, your thesis, Information Idol, How Google is Making Us Stupid, talks about how the search engine's methods are narrowing public dialogue. Based on his single-minded approach to aggression and hardness, is Darren Lehman coaching Australia using Google, and what does this say about his search history?
I did once meet a man who'd learned how to play the front foot defensive shot by Googling what it was all like. And if it worked out as badly for him, then I really don't want to see that becoming part of Darren Lehman's kit bag.
Gids, what gives you the right to have an opinion about cricket when you haven't even played any test matches?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I often say that Mike Atherton and I have played 115 test matches between us. And I figure I've stood close enough to him that at least a few of those test matches must have brushed off on me.
Just geographical proximity is enough.
Yeah. Gideon, word has it you don't drive and don't drink. How are you able to alpha a single person at your cricket club?
You're right. I'm a dismal failure in that respect. I mean, as I was getting into the car a few years ago with my daughter, she said, "Daddy, you can't drive." I said, no, I can't drive. She said, and you don't cook. I said, no, I don't cook. And she looked at me sympathetically for a moment, and a little smile came across her face, and she said, "But you can play cricket with your friends." I thought, she totally worked me out. She totally worked me out. The main slice of me in her short life has been Daddy walking out the door with his cricket bag over his shoulder.
Oh, that's a sad, sad state of affairs.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Gideon, you often appear on Offsiders.
Yes.
Perhaps the only reliable source of sports opinion on free-to-air television. However, it's hidden down the order in the low rating slot of Sunday morning. How many chops are you away from a prime-time berth on Q&A?
I must say, I've never actually watched Offsiders, and I'm completely unaware of who actually watches it. But it's it's classic El Cheapo ABC television. I think the fact that we share the same set of insiders should make us Michelle Guthrie's pin-up boys.
Gibbs, how inconvenient was it for you that your wife gave birth to your daughter in the middle of a Boxing Day test? And what excuse did you use to get out of it?
Good question. I actually got married in the mid-season break of the previous season. The priority, of course, was to make sure that I didn't miss a game for the Yarras. And I'm proud to say that I didn't even miss a training session. Funny enough, I did actually... I ran into Warnie the day before my wife was due to give birth. And he took one look at my wife and said, it's a boy. My wife looked that shape when we were having our boy. And, of course, it was a girl. So that's
Nostradamus.
But he said it with such confidence.
Speaking of Warnie, in On Warn, you actually compare Shane Warne with Jez from the UK sitcom Peep Show due to his ability to wander into mishap and misadventure so often that it sometimes suggested an unconscious relish for it. So if Warne is Jez, then am I right in guessing that Colin Miller is Superhands?
Eyebrow jokes.
It just opens up mind-boggling possibilities, doesn't it? But who is Big Suze?
Gideon, you say that you're not on social media, inverted commas. This question actually came in from a colleague of yours who wanted to remain anonymous. But they also say you're well across what's happening on social media. So what's the handle of your secret, presumably, egg Twitter account?
I've got absolutely no idea about it. I do have Peter Lawler, who is my eyes and ears. So I often tell him he's in touch. He's in touch with the young folk, but really, whole sort of social media storm has passed me by on a daily basis, and I'm sure that I'm missing out on something. But I can guarantee you that, frankly, if you ever see me on Twitter, you know that it's over. Because I always arrive at a new technology at the minute that it's becoming obsolete.
Yeah. Well, following on from that, Gids, I mean, you are frequently referred to as the greatest cricket writer in the world. Do you have any idea how hard it is to make a joke in 140 characters or less on the internet for 4.5 years?
I never want to find out. It's a problem with Twitter. I'm just too long-winded for it, I'm afraid.
Gids, your new book, as we discussed earlier, is based on the famous photograph of Trumper playing a staged cover drive in the early 1900s, arguably the most evocative image in cricketing history. Any truth to the rumour that your new book will focus on Glenn Maxwell's infamous reverse sweep while batting 3 in a test versus Pakistan and how that represents the general malaise in Australian society in the post-Warne Buchanan era?
No, you know, the funny thing is that some of the descriptions that I've heard of Trumper remind me of Glenn Maxwell. This capacity that was said that Trumper had for hitting an identical ball to six different places on the field. I thought, when I think of that, I think of Glenn Maxwell. So that's... I actually feel a strange wave of affection coming over me when I imagine the parallels. I can't see him sort of buying sheet music from an urchin in a London street for fear that the child will go to bed hungry. But look, I get as much pleasure from watching Glenn Maxwell as I do from any contemporary international cricketer. Precisely because I don't really know what's going to happen next. Maybe Glenn doesn't either.
When you ran a feature story on us for the Boxing Day edition of The Australian last year, was that the first time you realised that cricket in this country is seriously in trouble?
Look, it was...
It was a mistake.
I got a lot of pleasure out of that. I got a lot of pleasure out of discovering you guys. We sort of complain about the quality of cricket writing in Australia, and we complain about sort of the decline of, you know, what we regard as sort of these holy institutions. But I actually think that cricket writing is, in some sense, has never been more exciting and more various and more open to outside influences. And I actually feel a kind of a, having always fancied myself as a bit of an outsider cricket writer myself, this environment really, really suits me. It's, you know, I started writing for a fanzine back in 1990 with no cricketing background at all. I was a business journalist. And so, you know, it does my heart a lot of good when I see new, interesting, fresh voices entering into the field. The trick is, of course, to stay that way. I guess that's why you've sort of tackled a new milieu or a new the podcast. What do you do next? That's what the public is crying out for.
Yeah, they really are. It's been such a privilege to have you on, Gideon, this week. I think it's fair to say you're probably the most erudite guest we've had. It's between you and Brad Hogg.
Brad Hogg was good. I thought Merv was all right.
But it, really, a huge privilege for us, Gideon. Thank you so much for joining us and for your encouragement as well.
I'm absolutely wrapped. Look, the flip phone, how well does it last? It's been on one bar for the last half hour.
Don't make them like they used to.
I'll never get another one, too. I'll never get another one.
Good luck charging over the next couple of days.
Thanks, Gideon.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, boys. See ya.
Lads, that time of the week where we take your questions. The great cricketer followers, you can reach us on social media via Twitter or Facebook. This first question to us comes from Dan Ranson. He asks, is there a correlation between the number of sponsors on a training shirt and the quality of cricket?
No, there's not. And he actually, Dan lists a club team in here.
Well, I didn't want to mention the club.
Yeah, no, neither. But
for commercial reasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
And legal reasons.
But that club has 14 sponsors.
Yeah. 14 sponsors. Yeah. I think, I've always thought there was a correlation between the number of sponsors and their place in the community, and that the community actually liked the game.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Yeah. So I was kind of admired it and was a bit jealous of it.
Yeah.
But there are often find the sponsors are really kind of awkwardly placed on T-shirts, like to be fit in, like a really kind of tacky NRL side as well.
And you wouldn't want to, it depends on the tiers of sponsors as well, and I'm assuming these are all just, you know, local, you know, Danny's Auto Parts, Campbelldown, Camden, you know, isn't sitting alongside BHTP Billiton, you know, or some, none of that.
Yeah,
they're just 14 very, very small businesses all competing for space on a club cricket shirt.
Would that intimidate you, just seeing a side sponsored by KPMG?
Feel the same when I play Phil Mickelson at golf.
Callum Holloway writes in, playing my season in Australia from England, I came up against Brenton Parchment, former West Indies test player, two caps. It was 36 degrees and I was into my 12th over when Brenton dill scooped me over our keeper's head for four. I followed this with a can't you play a proper shot champ. And the very next delivery, he walked down the pitch as I was mid-run-up before pelting the ball over the sight screen for one of the biggest sixes I've ever seen. Looking past this, was I right to champ him originally? And should I stop name-dropping this into most cricket-related conversations I have with blokes I've just met?
Two-pronged question there.
Yeah.
Look, I think the champing is warranted. Don't you?
If you like losing.
Yeah.
See, my take on it...
I just think he's dill-scooped him first up.
Yeah.
And you have to, it's just a natural reaction to champ someone, regardless of their level or experience at the test arena. You have to champ him. And I like that Brenton Parchment has walked down the pitch as Callum is mid-run-up.
Yeah, I like it's not even in the delivery stride, like he just starts walking at it. Yeah.
How long's his run-up? Like 24 paces, he's walked up. He's 12 paces in, halfway from the sight screen, and you haven't seen it, but you've still been hit for one of the biggest sixes you've ever seen.
See, I think Callum here, he's come full circle because, I mean, first of all, Brenton Parchment obviously is West Indian, therefore cooler than everyone else in the game.
Immediately.
So therefore he can get away with dill scooping first ball. I think can't you play a proper shot champ is shit chat, if I'm being honest. But then Callum brings me back, and I've come full circle with him, by saying that should he be bringing this into conversations with blokes he's just met. I found that funny. So well played, Callum. So bad chat originally, sledging West Indian. Let him do whatever he wants to.
But keep dropping it in,
But keep dropping it in.
Adrian Walton, his moniker is at I'm Adge. Says, creams or whites? Is one more alpha? Does one show off the rig better than the other? Can we be quick with this?
Whites, yuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to creams v. whites, all I ask for is consistency. You can't have 11 blokes on the same team with various different shades of white or cream.
So spot on,
that's
Dave.
All I care about.
Yeah. The man writes in and says, do you pay for new training tops or wear the shirt from 8 or 9 years ago? Subtle reminder to all that you've been around for a bit. I really like that. He used the hashtag RCGC as well. That's fantastic. I mean, that's first thing that you do. You've got to wear the oldest club shirt that you have possible, giving you as much social capital as possible. Yeah.
When I started playing grade cricket, old stuff was good. It was kind of retro, vintage, someone's experience. I just wonder, like, the more we've thought about cricket, how long ago do you wear a shirt before it becomes embarrassing?
What does 2007 kit look like? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't look good. Doesn't
awkward
look like,
time,
I'm just assuming everything old looks like, you know, retro 80s or 90s kit, but it doesn't. It just looks bad and unfashionable.
Mm. If you're, like, 20 and you see someone in something from 1989, you're like, what are you still doing here?
When are you going to move on,
Can I read out a long one here from Facebook?
The Facebook ones are good. Yeah. And you know what? If the listeners have made it this far, they're listening to the end.
Okay.
or they're asleep.
Very presumptuous. Yeah.
And they'll hear
that. We got your click.
We got your download. Yeah.
Okay, Reg Roberts.
I might be watching the cricket.
Reg Roberts starts, he just says, guys, you focus a lot on the son-to-dad relationship, but what about the other? Understanding this isn't quite grade cricket, but it's the stepping stone, junior club cricket. Mm-hmm. He's a dad of three boys, Reg, 14, 12 and 10.
Yep.
And he goes on, he says, what's my expectations for watching their games? Should I be splitting my time evenly, or can I devote most of my time to the under 14s, whereby at least it resembles cricket rather than the under 10s, where it's more often than not just a game of wides interspersed with a bunch of overthrows? Oh. I'm torn between my duties as a dad and those as a cricket fan. Cheers, Reg.
Great question. Must just say, it's great that the dads are reaching out to us now. You know, usually we get children worrying about their relationship with their father, and now it's the absolute reverse.
Look,
I think, you know, splitting your time evenly is the diplomatic approach, but I personally would identify the one with the best talent relative to his age group.
Spot on.
Because when he eventually makes it, you can say that you taught him everything.
I mean, self-interest governs all, even if you're the father of three young humans trying to make their way and looking up to you for everything. You've still got to be self-interested.
I mean, this is why cricket's dying, right? Because, like, imagine, like, our parents drove across, for all three of us, they drove across the state.
Greater Sydney.
Sometimes interstate to watch rubbish, like, to watch me bat eight and not bowl. And just talk to parents that I thought he got along with well. Well, he hasn't kept in touch with them, so he obviously hated all of them.
And this is maybe something to throw out there to the listeners if you're still with us after this amount of time.
I'm actually
quite interested in the social dynamic between parents in cricket.
Yeah.
If you've got any questions out there for this section, just illuminating what it's like to deal with other parents and dads and mums. I think that's untapped stuff.
What about the parents that set up tents, like over on one side of the field? They always kind of, I'll get here first. It's like they're, you know, getting a good spot at, you know, the big day out or something. They're going to set up shop here.
Yeah.
Did you ever liaise with them? I'm imagining like a beach.
Yeah, the ones who sit the other side, they're always the rarest parents. And you're like the kind of place you go to the house and they've all got all weird stuff.
Yeah. There's always the dad who walks around the oval because he's just watching his son like a hawk as well. Knows everything about his average to three decimal point stuff.
He's happy to talk to a conference call to China.
Yeah, it's one or the other. It's definitely one or the other. Okay. I think we do well there. Max Denning says, again, it's a longish one. Dear TGC, I'm getting socially alphaed, more alpha stuff, by my ex-girlfriend. I find my friends preferring to spend time with her instead of me. How can I resolve this conflict with a grade cricketing mindset? Considering she doesn't play or understand cricket, so my state-level leg-side shots won't be appreciated. I have no way to alpha her back. My second instinct is to challenge... That's kind of a oxymoron, isn't it? Is to challenge my opponent to a fight. Won't work because she's a woman. What should I do to put alpha her?
This isn't easy. This isn't an easy one. Get yourself down to the gym. Get your pipes as big as possible. Make her jealous. Make her see what you're missing out on. And just she'll see those pipes and she'll be thinking, think of the maximums he's hitting now.
I mean, I'm already assuming his Facebook profile pic is him hitting a cover drive. So change that. Maybe put yourself, you know, one of those promotional shots of you at a nightclub. You've also asked us to resolve this with a grade cricketing mindset.
Yeah,
is there any flexibility on that?
No. I think it's go and get big pipes. It does wonders for your life.
Well, there's only one answer and it's pipes.
I mean, worst thing you can do is train legs. That's literally the worst thing that he could possibly do.
What a gargantuan show it's been this week, guys. I hope everyone out there enjoyed Gideon Hay. Something, a different perspective. Someone who can string words together better than anybody, really,
including us.
When it comes to cricket. Keep sending your questions in. Big thanks always to Shano, Jules and AJ for your help with the design, the graphics, the music, the voiceovers, the silly ads and stuff. We'll catch you guys next week.
Cheers.
Cheers.